I've been looking forward to this day, mainly because I'm going to go home at 10:30. I've only been here since May 11th, and so I'm very, very ready to leave. Enjoy being with you, but I'd rather see my family more. We had a military wingding with about 350 people here a couple of weeks ago, and you could tell it was a military wingding because when you walked in the door of the Bighorn, the whole place smelled like a dirty sock. I remember one day I came in, I just got to air this place out. You just, sorry about that, Jeff. But it was a super time. God really blessed during that time. When we first planned this conference, as I recall, that the regional directors and the U.S. leadership team, we had Sheffield came up with assigned topics for each RD. And then they scrubbed that and said, go with whatever you want. But in some conversations, it looked like I should keep the assigned topic. And so that's what I'm going to do today, in that for the majority of the time today, I'm going to be speaking on the issue of integrating and supervising women's staff in the ministry. So that will be the topic as we go through it. Now, I would like to tell you that the RDs, except for Terry, he left. We've been observing you very carefully during this time. And we have a little notice that will be included in our policies from here on out for all staff. And it has to do with absences from work. And the first one has to do with sickness. There is no excuse for sickness. We will no longer accept your doctor's statement as proof. We believe that if you're able to go to the doctor, you're able to come to work. The second issue, an issue in the Navigator for some while has been leave of absences, and this is a leave of absence for an operation. We're no longer allowing this practice. We wish to discourage any thoughts that you may need an operation, as we believe as long as you're an employee here, you need all of whatever you have, and you should not consider having anything removed. We hired you as you are, and to have anything removed certainly would make you less than we bargained for. The third topic has to do with death, your own. This will be accepted, but we would like to know 2 weeks in advance, as we feel it is your duty to teach someone else your job and see that all the necessary paperwork is in order. Now, the last is a little bit of a touchy issue. It's on restrooms. There's entirely too much time spent in the restrooms. In the future, we will follow the practice of going in alphabetical order. For instance, those whose names begin with A will go from 8 to 8:15, those with B from 8:15 to 8:30, and so on. Now, if you're unable to go at your appointed time, it'll be necessary for you to wait till the next day when your turn comes up again. That was an interesting little thing. You can work that out on a regional basis, I'm sure. I'd like to share just a little bit of my personal testimony with you just before we get into the things that I would like to share, both from the Word and on the topic that I'd like to share with you today. I was born in a very small town in Iowa, just north of Ames, a little place called Garden City, which is now the same size as it was when I was there, 100 people, 3 street lights, a beer joint, a grain elevator on the Rock Island Railroad. Occasionally a gas pump. They'd keep shutting that thing on and off, and I suppose it's off now. And there, when I was a very young child, I went to a church, which, of course, as you know, in a Scandinavian community, was a Lutheran church. I didn't realize that until I was practically an adult, what kind of church it was. And in that church, I was under the opinion that a Christian was, first, an old man. Secondly, it was someone who went to church all the time. And thirdly, someone who could pray rather sanctimoniously and with a quiver in his voice. Because I remember one fellow, it was such an interesting thing. If you remember, if any of you go to a Lutheran church, they used to have these small hymnals with just the words in them. And I was quite impressed how he could put his whole hand around that whole thing when he prayed. And I don't know why that impressed me, but that impressed me at that point in time. I thought it must be a spiritual mark. But I did not hear the gospel insofar as I know. My parents had been divorced when I was just an infant, and my mother remarried shortly after World War II, or right at the end of it, and then we moved to Spokane, Washington. Going from a town of size 100 to what to me was a metropolis, where I went from a one-room schoolhouse where we had 3 kids in my grade, And two graduated, by the way, when I left. I mean, it doesn't grow around that place. To a schoolroom that had as many people in my class as we did in my entire school. In fact, more. It was a trauma to me and a shock. And we didn't go to church anywhere. I rather withdrew. And with a new stepfather, life was not altogether that easy. After we'd been there 3 or 4 years, finally somebody talked me into going into a small community Sunday school that a businessman had started in the area. And in that Sunday school, I was in the class of a man by the name of Bob Shepler, a single businessman who really taught the word. He was really a disciplinarian. I mean, he ran the thing like a little military school. It was just junior high boys, wild as they come, and he would spend his days going around that housing project that we lived in, rounding up kids from wild backgrounds, and I was one of them. And he very clearly shared the word, very straight, just time after time after time, sharing how that a person had no relationship with God unless they had Christ as their Savior, and the reason they needed him was because they had sin in their life, and that was becoming very obvious in my life, and I knew I had sin. Well, he would share this consistently, but he did not only share it, but he gave his life to us. He was a man who would take us swimming and fishing and hiking, and we'd go down in the Blue Mountains of southern Washington, and I would get to observe his life outside that room that we met in on Sunday mornings, and he was the same everywhere. He was a guy whose life was given over to God, and he had given his life to kids, and he really invested himself, and we all knew that it was quite a task, because Bob had a hip problem where he could hardly walk. It was very hard for him to walk. In fact, today, he just drags his feet and his whole back is given out and he's in constant pain. And I see him regularly whenever I go through my hometown. But he gave himself to us. And one time, coming back from a swimming outing, the guy from Whitworth College who was helping him in his class just asked if any of us kids would like to accept Christ. And I had thought about it. I'm sure it was over a year. And I said, I'd like to do that. I bowed my head, asked Christ to come into my life. I knew exactly what I was doing. There was no question that this was something that was a lifetime situation. In fact, I remember getting out of the car, walking directly into my house and telling my parents what had happened because it was significant. And through that process, God has reached into our entire family. My father, stepfather, my mother, all my brothers have come to know Christ. When we first came to Colorado in 64, I became well acquainted with my real father, who lives up in Longmont, and my stepmother on that side came to know Christ. Then a few years later, my dad came to know the Lord, and all the kids of that family have come to know Christ. And so God has used that one man in my life to reach my entire family, and that might be an encouragement to a few of you. For instance, my stepmother made the remark after she finally received Christ that everything I ever gave her to read, she burned. She said, my father was an atheist and going to hell, and that's exactly what I was going to do. I happened to give her one book that was a hardbound book, The Burden is Light by Eugenia Price. She said, I just didn't have the heart to burn a hardbound book. And one day, just before Christmas, one Sunday, she called and said, Jerry, can you come up? I've been reading this book, and I just need to know how to become a Christian. And I couldn't go up. You'd think I'd drop everything, wouldn't you? And I said, Marge, can you come down? And, of course, my dad wasn't supportive of it at all. And I had a responsibility at the Air Force Academy that morning, to teach a class that I felt, and there was just no way to get out of it. I said, can you come down in the afternoon, on Sunday afternoon? And they said, well, if it doesn't snow, we'll be there. Well, it didn't snow here, but it snowed there. And they didn't come. So I called that night, and she had went through and gotten the Bible out and came to know Christ on her own. So it was an amazing deal, what God has done. And the encouragement to me is that the life of Christ in you and in your family shines through. They used to like to come to our home, still do. In fact, Dave has them down here as guests pretty regularly when they come down here to the Glen. So I received Christ, went on into high school, through the influence of this businessman, became very involved, not only in his business, and he really trained me. I got more training from him than I did from the navigators. He taught me how to live my life, how to deal with people, how to be disciplined. I lived with him in the summers, this was before he got married, and he would just, you know, he would put demands on me you wouldn't think you'd do to a high school kid. And I had to do it right. He could run Glen Eyrie. I'm telling you, he and John Crawford would be a pair. During the decade of development, one of the reps up there went and called on him. And he doesn't know anything about music, but he owns a big music store because he's a good businessman. So he sits up on the balcony of this big music store in an old GI desk and his sack lunch sitting there. And, you know, the guys he's hired all have nice offices back in there, but he sits out there and makes sure things run right. Well, one of the guys came to call him on Decade of Development back here a while and gave the spiel, and he says, well, so I'm going to put my money where it counts. I'm going to give it to Jerry and send him packing. And, you know, it was just, he just liked that. But, you know, that taught me some things, that he made demands on my life that developed my character, and that I could see that for years and years and years that life was more than just reading the Bible. When I was in high school, I was an activist, got very involved in Youth for Christ, got very involved in my church, organized everything that there was to organize, and was feeling very empty. I tried to witness. I remember when I'd have give devotionals, I didn't know where to turn. You know, just kind of flip the Bible open. From the time I came to know Christ, though, I had a quiet time. I can't remember a time in my life since I became a Christian where I did not attempt to have a quiet time and read my Bible daily and started reading my Bible through, as I recall. Started in Genesis. It was tough, but I went. No one quite told me what I should do, but I did it. But when I left high school, because of my activities, all the people around church says, oh, you ought to go in the ministry. And I thought, baloney. I said, if I went in the ministry, I'd be a hypocrite. So I won some contest with Youth for Christ, couldn't go to camp, and went out and bought a slide rule with the money. And they didn't think that was very spiritual. But I needed a slide rule, so you go off to engineering school and you get your slide rule. Now you buy a calculator. And I got to the University of Washington, and my first roommate was Ron Ortley. Ron had only known Christ 2 years, and he had been led to Christ by a varsity tennis teammate in Seattle. But yet there was something about Ron's life that was different. He seemed to know how to get into the Bible, he knew how to study it, and he knew how to have a quiet time. And so I asked Ron if he would start helping me in that, and we met daily for I don't know how long, every single day, man to man. And he didn't know much, but he taught me everything he did know, which is all I needed, was how to get into the Scriptures. We didn't know anything about evangelism because in the late 50s, the Navigators weren't doing much evangelism at all. In summer of 58, when I lived with the Nav Rep in Seattle, Navigators were going through a real transition, and you remember Lee Sundstrom, Lila, lived with Lee and Phyllis that summer, and things were, you know, it wasn't an easy time for the Navigators, but I didn't know. I was just trying to figure out who they were. And it didn't matter to me, the organizational things, but yet I sensed that there was something that the Navs had given Ron in his life that changed his motivation and made him a different person, and that what he shared with me was very practical. And so when I left the University of Washington, Mary and I were married there, and I went on active duty in the Air Force, we kept man-to-man contact with Ron for 2 or 3 years by tape recording. And it was during that time that God really got a hold of my attention to change my activity cycle around and start focusing my life. And when I was down at Cape Canaveral, I ran myself into the ground physically trying to do everything. And God really got my attention before I went off for a master's degree, did two things for me. One is it made me alerted me to the fact that I was ignoring my family. Secondly, that what I was doing was lots of activity again, even though in the middle of it I had a good Bible study, was doing personal Bible study, was becoming consistent in my own life in many ways without anybody really pounding on my head, and was meeting man-to-man with somebody. I mean, I was helping someone. But yet, there was that sense that I was just doing it in addition, and it was tearing up everything. So when we moved to Dayton, Ohio in 1962, there is where I had made a commitment in my life to change my lifestyle and focus my life, and that was a great change. We used to have Vedano over and Dave Johnson and get Jack Mayhall down once in a while, and Bob Sparks had moved to Columbus around that time, and we just invite him down to kind of help us in whatever we were trying to do there at Dayton, Ohio. And God really started giving me more of a heart for how to help other people. I'll never forget the first NAV conference I went to there. I'd gone to one in South Carolina, and I'd been through the Glen. But went to a one-day conference that Sparks was arranging, and they figured I been around a while, so I could go ahead and lead a workshop. And said, would you lead a workshop on the hand? And I said, sure, I'll be glad to lead a workshop on the hand. And I said, would you review that for me again? See, just somehow, off in the boonies by myself, nobody had ever shown me the hand illustration. Because, when you're out and away, you just aren't in the system. And so I led a workshop. I said, fine, thank you very much, and went home and worked out a workshop on the hand illustration. But then the Lord just gradually began developing in Mary's and my life. Back as early as 1960 and 61, God put on our hearts the Air Force Academy and began praying consistently about that until we finally arrived there in 1964 through a series of, really, a number of miracles that I won't bore you with at this point. It's interesting but not pertinent to what we're doing. And after spending 2 years there, went back to Purdue University again, continued involvement with the NAVS and the what was then the Great Lakes region, and back here again in 68, and then we left active duty after 13 and a half years in the Air Force in 1973, March 1. And we're very encouraged. God has very clearly led us. We have, since the time we did that and changed the career, we have never had one backward glance, Mary or me. And I really think or our kids, from all that we've been able to see. So God's been very, very gracious. As I look back on the times of my life, I'm pretty well a choleric person, and I don't get depressed and down too easily. I have at times. But as we see people in the ministry and sense my own internal responses in the context of a ministry, I think there are often that we see that discouragement and depression just kind of flood in at some point in our lives and overpower our emotions and incapacitate us in the ministry. And now, if difficult times haven't come for you, as a pastor here in Colorado Springs said on Sunday, suffering, if you haven't had suffering, it will come. And there will come a time when you are really wrestling with the issue of whether or not God wants you where you are. And so what is it that keeps you going? Now, I think some of the fellows have shared some things on this. But I'd like you to turn for just a few moments in the Word before I go on to some practical issues, to 2 Corinthians 4. In the Bible study that I'm leading in Seattle with a group of couples, we've been studying 2 Corinthians this spring. And I'd like to just spend maybe 5 minutes together in 2 Corinthians 4. Therefore, since we have this ministry as we received mercy, we do not lose heart. That "do not lose heart" comes up three places that I know clearly. Here in 2 Corinthians 4:1, over in 2 Corinthians 4:16, then in Hebrews 12:3 and 4. The word "lose heart," don't be discouraged. But notice very carefully, it says, since we have this ministry, we have it just like we received mercy. Now, how did you receive mercy? By grace of God, right? Whatever happens in the ministry is not of you. It's not of me, but it's of God. We've received our mercy, our ministry, by grace. It says, since we've received it by grace, we do not lose heart. You see, the thing that drives us down is when we fail. Isn't that true? Most of my discouragements have been because of an issue of pride in what I perceive to be some failure in my own life, or I've been angry at myself and disappointed in my responses. Most things are. You see, I lose heart because of myself. But God says it in your ministry anyhow. Therefore, don't lose heart. But it goes on and says, now, in conjunction with that, it says, but instead of losing heart, we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. We don't lose heart, and one of the things that will keep you from doing that is that we live a holy life, we handle the word of God honestly, and we commend our lives to other men's consciences. And you say, well, wait a minute. Isn't my conscience just between me and God? Apparently not. The fact is that you allow other people to run your lives. Other people influence how you conduct yourself. And in the context of ministry, we are not responsible just to God and your RD. You're responsible to the people to whom you minister. and the way you live your life has to do with their consciences as well as your own. Then you go on to, down to verse 5. It says, "For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and ourselves as your bondservants for Jesus' sake. We don't preach ourselves, but Christ. For God, who said, 'Light shall shine out of darkness,' is the one who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Now, that's quite a verse to meditate on, by the way. Just to think through what that verse means, the way our life reflects Jesus Christ. Then verse 7 is very important to me in this study. "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing greatness of the power may be of God and not from ourselves." The fact is that you and I are imperfect people. We're earthen vessels. Stuff goes through us and it clings inside and you can't get it clean. See, a vessel that you can't scrub like aluminum and be perfectly clean. We're an earthen vessel which is fragile, not very good looking, only useful inasmuch as the master uses the vessel and he has the right to mold it in every way. But God says there's a purpose to that, that we're earthen vessels, so the power will never be of ourselves. And one of the things that frightens me in our NAV ministry is how qualified so many of you are, how intelligent you are, and how gifted you are and how many abilities you have. It's a great danger that you will think, and I will think, that the power is of myself. But God will take care of that because we are earthen vessels. And it said that at some point in our lives that we will see that the power is of God and not from ourselves. Then the next little passage is so tremendous. It says, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body." Our very humanity relates us with the person of Christ and his suffering. And we carry about in our body a dying person. And then everything from outside comes in and crashes in on us, but never, by the promise of God, breaks us. Never. See, we are people for whom there is no affliction that is fatal, because God is our sustainer. And then just skipping to the last part of this chapter, in verse 16, again, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day." God daily is renewing us. That's in the passive, being renewed, passive, constant, always. God is doing it in our lives. "For the momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look at the things which are seen," not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. "For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are seen, not seen, are eternal." The word "look" is to seek, to search, to dwell on, to let it occupy our minds. So as you embark on this time with the NAVs, I realize many of you have been around the NAVs for many years, but this is a beginning point in some ways. What is it you're looking for? What is it you're fixing your eyes upon? Surely it must not be a staff position, but it has to be a call from God to a vision and to a co-laborship with others of similar vision, the navigators. What are you looking at? It says if you look at things that are temporal, you're going to be disappointed. But say we look at things that are eternal, because only the things that are eternal will not disappoint you. And if you expect me as a person or Bob Lewis as an individual, especially Bob, you're really going to be disappointed. Now, if you look at anybody in the navigators close enough, you're going to find some real chinks in the armor. Because it says we're earthen vessels, and nobody's any different. And if you look hard enough, you're going to find some real gaps. So God is going to reward you according to what you're looking for. And the affliction will be very difficult if your affliction is focused, you know, you think it comes from people. But it says, "For we look not at the things which are temporal, but the things which are eternal." And that's how the momentary light affliction that it says. Now, Paul's, his underplay is something else here. He's in prison, you know, he's getting beaten, he's going to die and all this. The momentary light affliction, he says, produces for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. Well, I trust that God will take some of that word, and as we reflect on the topic that we're going to talk about today, which is the ministry as it relates to working together as men and women in the ministry, I trust that maybe some of these things will even help. Because in the context of human relationships, there's a lot of room for losing heart. Because in human relationships, you will always be disappointed and there will always be problems. And so as we go into some of this today, I trust that God will give you just some insight in your own life and in your own spirit. I don't pretend in this time to be speaking for all the regions for anybody except to share with you some very practical issues that I feel are important on the topic of integrating and supervising women's staff in a ministry. Now, as we get into this, I realize that over the years there have been a lot of discussions. Today, women's issues are just tearing apart the Christian community, the women's lib situation, the evangelical women's caucus. Everything is going on. Now, in my contact with women's staff and the Navigators, our mature women, none of them are in that camp. They are not in the camp of women's lib. They're not trying to be something. They're not using it as a vehicle to push through. I think in the integrity of their hearts, their purpose is to serve God. But in the context of a very predominantly men's ministry, historically, we have to see, how do you integrate the ministry to women? And so as I go through this, I'd like to make four assumptions. Now, we can do studies all over the place on some of these situations, and that should be done. But for the basis of what we're talking about today, I'd like to make four basic assumptions. Now, let me just tell you the pattern of what I'd like to do. It's 9:42. I'm going to leave at 10:30. You can see, after I give this, you'll see why I want to leave. Now, I really isn't that bad. But I'd like to see if I can't go through the main part of what I'm going to share within the next 30 minutes, and then to give about 20 minutes for some interaction. Normally, we could just crowd around at coffee break, but I love you, but I love my wife and kids more, and I'm going to leave. So I will be leaving at that time, but I want plenty of time to interact. And besides, many of these issues need to be worked out in the context of your local ministry. But I think some of the things that I'm going to share will have universal enough appeal to and validity to pursue. First of all, the assumptions. Where am I here? Okay. The first assumption, can you all see that okay? You'll have to pardon me for my writing if you can't read it. It's life. I can't do it like Bordy did. Okay. A women's ministry is valid in the Navigators, both biblically and in concert with our AIM and the FOM. Now, perhaps more study needs to be done in some of these issues. It's one of the imperatives that came out of the International Leadership Conference, but nevertheless, I think we must start with that as an assumption. Otherwise, I have a different topic that we have to bring forward today and discuss it. So let's take that as a given. The second thing is, women have access to all spiritual gifts. As far as I can determine, in the listing of gifts, there is not gender to gifts. Not male or female. Women can have gifts of leadership. Women can have gifts of helps, exhortation, serving, hospitality. All the gifts are as available to women as they are to men. They are expressed differently. But as far as I can tell, the gifts are available equally to all Christians. Thirdly, NAV staff women should function under a man's leadership. We have made that as a decision. I believe it is a biblical decision, and that is the route that we are going. And fourthly, women staff comprise a primary part of our ministry to women. It's not all of it. Many of you wives should be ministering to women consistently, intently, if it's within your gifting. Some of you will do it more than others. But we are going to deal with women's staff, and women's staff, I believe, for some time to come, will be a significant part of our Navigator ministry to women. Okay? So those are four basic assumptions. You see why I'm making those as assumptions, so that I can deal with one particular aspect of the women's ministry today. So from this point on, what I am going to do is deal with the topic of how to supervise and integrate women in a woman's staff. Now remember, I am talking about a women's staff person, okay, into the ministry. Now I'd like to just share something with you from Luke chapter 6, verse 31, that I think is a fundamental rule as to how you function in human relationships. And I'd like you to apply it in this context. Okay, men, if think about it, and women, you think about it too. In Luke 6:31, we have what's referred to as the golden rule. And just as you want men to treat you, treat them in the same way. So men, I would like you to view yourself as a single person going into a ministry where there is a couple who is a representative running the ministry, and you are going in to participate in their ministry as contact staff. Now, we have enough multiple staffing experience to know that sparks fly at times, okay, and that isn't easy. Now, you think about that as to how you would like to be dealt with and how you would like to be treated in that context. And the word that I would like to have you remember most through this whole thing is the word co-laborship. As you look at Philippians 4:3, we see that it's very clear that Paul had co-laborers who were women. In Philippians 4:3, it says, "Indeed, true comrade, I ask you to help these women who have shared in my struggle in the cause of the gospel, together with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers or co-laborers, whose names are recorded in the book of life." In Romans 16:1-16, in those people that Paul listed as his dearest friends and co-laborers, half of them were women. And then also look at the scriptures as to how Jesus treated and included women. And then fundamentally, from one of our early memory verses, John 13:34-35, how we treat one another as men and women, in general, is a testimony to the world. That's how others see us and how they view us. Are you a little warm? Can we turn the air conditioner on over there? Somebody that knows how to flip that little switch up there on. I don't want you going to sleep. Normally the subject matter will keep you awake, but... Okay, so just some fundamental things. If you would keep this perspective that we are co-laborers in Christ. So the first thing that I would like to say, and this is my first time through this. All I've done is go through this with one of the people in my region and teaching that person how to integrate a new women's staff. And that's how this study sort of developed, in trying to put together mostly the mistakes I've seen myself and others make. So this is born out of a good bit of experience. The first thing is the woman should go as staff, not as a team leader. If they're going to be staff, let them be staff and come in on that basis. And as staff, they should have a job description where they know what they're responsible for. None of you want to move to an area and you come in and you say, "What do you want me to do?" "Oh, I'll just kind of hang around and minister to a few people if you can find somebody. Or just sort of be friends with the people." No, we want to have a job description. And women need a job description when they come in as staff. Secondly, they should report to the staff man, not to his wife or to some other team leader. They should report to the staff man on the scene at that time. Thirdly, it's my conviction personally that they should be in on state staff meetings. I do not want to engender an additional level of leadership. For instance, when we have multiple staff targets, when we put another contact staff in who reports to the staff man on the scene, both of them go to my state director staff meetings and planning for the state. The one guy doesn't go out and leave the other guy home who is a contact staff also, or is a contact staff, and the other one may be a rep. So I just try to prevent additional levels of leadership, because the women in that sense will give clear direction. If you did not do that, women would not be in on any planning meetings almost. And they do need to be in that situation. Now, the structure of the state, of course, could make that a little different. But in general, I would like them to be in on the staff meetings that the staff men that they report to are in on. Now, let's talk for a moment about the responsibility of the staff man. The key is co-laborship. just like it is with all of us, as well as leadership. Both are important, but this is a key. Again, I want to emphasize, because of the kinds of tensions that often come in relating to the staff man's wife, that the staff woman is to report to the man, not his wife, and that the staff woman should be good friends with the wife. I feel that one of the greatest things that can enhance the relationship as a in a ministry is for, if there is a woman's contact staff or a woman's rep, that that woman and the wife of the staff man become fast good friends, which means they do not conduct business together. Nor does she go around the staff guy and discuss all of her problems with that gal and with the wife. Nor does the wife, and if the wife has confidence and there's a friendship, then there is not that threat. Some wives, you know, say, well, gee, I don't know whether I want my hubby out meeting with this woman and just doing this, that, and the other thing. And I think you need to handle things carefully. And if that friendship is there, it'll be a good relationship. It'll be one of the fundamentals. Thirdly, the staff man should meet weekly at a specified time with the woman. And the things, there are many things that he ought to do, but some of them are to monitor her finances, monitor her schedule, and monitor her physical needs, such as her car, the home, just issues that for a woman are not all that easy to cope with. So to monitor those things, be aware of them, and to know them. Include her in on all campus planning. I have seen situations where the staff man and the team men team leaders get together and plan the whole thing, and I hear that the women are just over there in the corner, and then they kind of get the word down the line what's going to happen this year. I believe that the staff woman, and perhaps if they have mature enough women, that a couple of the women team leaders should also be in on the campus planning meetings. Even when the plans may predominantly relate to some of the men's portion, because it cannot help but affect one another. And I'll have some comments on that later. In fact, I recommend that the male staff and the female staff pre-plan. In other words, don't treat the woman as coming into that meeting just being another team leader, but that they ought to get together and maybe go over what they're going to discuss. And, you know, none of you walk into a meeting with no plans. You don't just walk in ignorant and empty. Some of you may, but that's a problem if you do. You know, you go in with some plans and some thinking. Well, if it's a co-ed ministry, you ought to go in with some things thought out together so that big surprises do not occur to her in the middle of that meeting and she be called upon to speak and say, gee, I don't agree. You know how that makes you feel. So you see, if you do a little work ahead of time. Leroy had some tremendous advice for me about 10 years ago, 9 years ago. I can remember it as clear as day on a particular issue. And he says that plans sprung unannounced tend to call forth a negative response. And so you have to sow the seed. You have to discuss things. Be in communication. Now, as you're taking notes, I'll come back to clarify any of those in a moment, but if we get off into too many things, I'm concerned that we won't get through, and then I'll be frustrated. You may not be. Okay. The fifth thing is include her in the staff man's Bible study about 50% of the time. Now, this is hard. This is not always easy. But I have found that on some campuses, the women's staff don't get in-depth Bible study because they're not in one. And if the women's ministry is young, you lead the DFDs or the SCLs or Young Studies, and I believe that it's very good in the key meetings, the in-depth study on campus, that the staff woman be on it. Not all the time. She may have one with some very key girls. But even there are times when the women team leaders and the men team leaders and the staff man and staff woman can be in a study together. You can start together, split up. There are many ways you can work it. And it doesn't have to be all the time, but enough such that you ensure as a staff man that she is getting enough depth in the Word and that relationships are developing around the Word, not around business. Do you see the difference? If all you do is meet weekly and you just talk the business and her plans and her schedule, that gets very dry and very cold, especially to a woman. And I think you need the context. It's like much of our ministry, Mary's and mine in the past, like when we were at the academy, it was all the men. And I think she'd be willing to share this. She said, there got to be times like I thought my whole life was just dumping food in ungrateful mouths. You know, and she was just kind of off on the side, and she wasn't in on any of my key Bible studies. And now as I reflect on it, Mary did not get the development in Bible study that she could have had I provided something that could be in there. Some of your team leaders are married. Well, you need to provide to make sure that the gals also develop. By the way, don't slip the women's staff into a wives' Bible study. That would not, in general, that would not be good. Now, everything I'm saying has qualifiers. You understand that. If I come a little strong, it's to make a point. But there are various ways you can work these. I'm trying to communicate some principles of operation. Give her encouragement, feedback, and direction. Don't just let her do whatever she wants. Now, I have yet to see a navigator staff man fired because he doesn't make the women's work go well. Now, I think most of us can understand that. So here you are, perhaps a young contact staff, going out on your first ministry, and you know that you've got to develop that men's ministry. And I've just observed this at various times. The guy is so focused on developing his ministry, and the gal comes, and no matter what she says, says, great, great, just keep doing it, go do it. Do anything you want, just keep off my back. And instead of giving her direction and help, evaluation, and you need to be then well informed of her ministry. You need to know what she is doing, who she is meeting with, and what she is doing with them. Don't just let her go off and do anything that she wants and just say, I want to keep peace at all costs. You may even be at conflict at some time because none of us like to be told what to do. But the point is there is a security in direction. I have talked to people who say, listen, what's my supervisor supposed to do? He never tells me I'm doing anything good. He never tells me I'm doing anything bad. He just says, keep going. You know, just do, you're doing great. But you know, in your mind, you're not doing great. Same with a woman. You need to give her that feedback. And treat her as a woman. I believe that many of the women in our staff have been forced to function as a man functions. And because it's a men's organization, and often in meetings with men, they have to try and learn to think that way, and occasionally we'll come across that way. But inside, they don't, you know, when you treat them in return like a man, it really hurts. And it is not the right way to do it. Remember that she is a woman, and she has feelings of a woman, and would like to be treated like a woman, just like your wife would. Okay, so that is the issue on what a rep, that is some ideas on the responsibility of a staff man. Now let's give some hints for the woman's ministry for just a moment. Just there's so many that you could put in on this, and I'm only going to give a few. The first is, don't attempt a, quote, training apartment too early. We had one situation where it was the girl was going in, didn't know anybody, and an apartment was going to be formed training-wise too soon. We said, and I said, well, no, don't do that, because the woman needs to select as well as the man, and you can't form a training apartment when people are not ready for training. Now, she needs a roommate and she needs a friend initially. And maybe a training situation will occur. Now remember, I'm talking right at this point about an earlier ministry, a younger ministry, integrating an initial ministry with women. So don't try as much as you hear about training apartments, don't try it too early. Because it's just like trying to adopt your key team too quick. And also remember, you want to be out on the campus. You don't want to hole up in an apartment too early in the ministry. See, you got to decide, where is your ministry? Is it in the apartment or is it in the ministry? Well, it depends on what your objective is at that point in the development of the ministry. Have the woman out on campus. I mean, she doesn't just sit back, just like the rep doesn't sit back and send out people to do the ministry. She needs to be out there and involved with people. Give her help in strategy and tactics for her ministry. There are some women who are very good at that, by the way. But it's both for the staff man and for the staff woman, okay? But it's important for both. One is friendship. You can't function in just a business relationship. The second is counsel about what is happening in the women's ministry. And the third has to do with evaluation. Now, perhaps those two ought to be reversed, but I just happen to write them down in that order. And it's because they have insight. It's just like someone coming in from the outside really can discover things. Now, I personally find when I do meet, when I go to a campus with the women, and the women team leaders and through it, but I don't seem to have quite the same insight. they don't reveal themselves to me in the same sense in which they would to a more mature woman. And therefore, I don't get quite the picture that I think a woman can have who helps. Now, she does not have the authority. The man on the scene has the authority. That's why I put friendship, counsel, and evaluation. Very important. And we could discuss that further if you wish. Now, I only want to mention one thing on training for women's staff. I'd like you simply to remember that women need training and development as well as the men. Just like you want training and development, she needs it. Therefore, help them plan it and get it. If you need women's key women's conferences, if you need seminars, if you need to call somebody in to help, whatever it is, help them get it. They need that development just like you need it. And they want it just as badly as you want it. So help them to get that. Now, overall, in the women's ministry, I would like to just highlight to you what I consider be to the 9 major problem areas that get us in trouble in a women's ministry. And I won't discuss these in depth. Each one of these could be a workshop on how to do this. The first one is communication. Just like in marriage, just like with your supervisor, just like with your friends, if you don't communicate well on a biblical basis, you're going to have trouble. And most situations that I see develop between men and women, and between husband and wives, starts out as an issue of communication first. And then it goes to other things. The second is the issue of the role of women and marriage. There are philosophical issues. There are biblical issues. There is not complete agreement, even among the Navigator staff, about where those fit. Now, I feel in most discussions there's more agreement than we admit. But what happens is each of us have not what I call convictions, but we have a little bit of prejudices, you know, and so we kind of hammer on that edge of it. And there's about 10% where we don't have maybe an important 10, but there are some differences. And so that issue can come up and be a major problem area, and you just have to hassle that out. You have to do some studies for yourself, and she does, and so forth. Yes? Okay, number one is the role of women in the body of Christ. What responsibilities can they have? Is it right to have women's staff? Can they have leadership to some degree? How can they express their gifts? How much responsibility should they have? Then the marriage is the only thing in life for a woman, marriage, and it is the highest good for all people. In other words, can God call someone, man or woman, to be single for a period of time? Or for a life, for that matter? That issue, and putting such an emphasis on marriage that we develop a kind of a second-class citizen mentality. Do you see what I mean? Now, that can come about. And, you know, we live with our feelings. And by the way, someone pointed out to me recently, you also live with your culture, how you're brought up. When you're from a certain culture, background, part of the country, and so forth, no matter what the Bible says, your feelings don't always go with what the Bible may teach objectively. That happens in all kinds of areas. And, you know, it's interesting. Someone has said the difference between conviction and prejudice is that you can share a conviction without getting angry. Think about that for a little bit. Okay, a major problem area is schedule. Women tend to work themselves to death. They're loyal, faithful, often perfectionist, and just work themselves to death. And then their schedule is different. They can't run a schedule like a man does. They're built differently. There are differences in relationships. Men get by with just the vaguest and poorest of interpersonal relationships in some issues. I don't know why it is, but men can be in absolute conflict with other men and still function. Women can't, generally. And I've confirmed that in my workshops on the job. Every time I've said, isn't it true, women, that when you're at work, if you have a conflict with a coworker, you're just devastated? And every woman in the audience just about it, just nodding their head. I said, now, men, you get along just fine, don't you? They go, oh, yeah, conflict where? They don't even know it exists, hardly. And, you know, I can do that at times. I remember in my secular work, I could have a wild argument and be angry almost and just go out and have coffee afterwards. Okay, lack of direction. I think one of the major problems areas is that women are given their head, go do whatever you want, they do, and then we become upset with them. Because they've taken a different direction than we had really wanted. If you give them direction, same thing with your wife. You tell her to go do whatever she wants, men, and pretty soon you're going to live with that. just like you. If your state director says, just gee, do anything you want, about 5 years down the road, there will be a judgment coming. And you say, but you didn't tell me. That may be true, but we still got the problem when it comes. A fifth problem is the issue of usurping leadership. I think it is possible for a woman to usurp leadership over a man. That is one of the commands given in the Scriptures, that women are not to usurp authority. But I have seen marriage after marriage where the man abdicated his responsibility and the woman became the leader in the home and ultimately determined the direction of the ministry. I have seen people who marry and they do not take spiritual leadership, and it is just a matter of time until that comes home to roost in the marriage, because women have the same gifts. It's expressed differently. If a woman has a gift of leadership, she will attempt to lead. And if you do not give leadership, she will eventually, out of necessity, lead. Now, occasionally there are bad motives. Women, I have noticed that occasional woman will sin as well as a man. And I've noticed that they have, once in a while, have done something wrong. And frankly, that, you know, there will be times where you may encounter a situation where a woman just says, I want to lead. In fact, you may encounter a situation where a man says, I want to lead, when he ought to follow. So this is a problem that I'm just pointing out, and it is alleviated by this one, by lack of direction. If you give direction, then you will not have the problem of a woman usurping leadership. The issue of feelings are very, very important in the context of a ministry, in that there are feelings that are there, emotional feelings about the communications that are taking place. And you just have to learn to deal with them. They're hard to find sometimes, but they're on both the part of the men and the women. There's the issue of insecurity for both. And I have written down a couple statements that I feel are important to keep in mind, providing I can keep it here, find it here on my notes. Where am I? Yeah, the insecurity for both people. Wait a minute here, I'm lost. Okay, it's going to come up later. Okay, the issue of security. We often lay blame and say, oh, you know, a person's having a problem. Well, they're just really insecure. I haven't yet met one who wasn't insecure. I have not met a man or a woman who, if you pushed the right button and put them in the right circumstance, did not become very insecure. Me, you, no matter how much bravado there may be, there is insecurity. I believe there, in the working of men and women, there are insecurities on both sides. You have a very capable woman, and she will make some men feel insecure. And she may feel insecure. It goes both ways. So the security must focus on God, and we must make sure that there is an issue of security with God dealing with His sovereignty. And then the issue of fear of failure. Everybody needs verbal reinforcement and realistic evaluation. Now, verbal reinforcement does not mean that the woman should become totally dependent upon the staff person so she can't work for anyone else, or where he shields her from getting help from other quarters. See, I would not want a state director to shield me from going to the heart of an issue with a contact staff out in the ministry. Would you? Because I might see something that's different. So we have to watch an over-dependence that the staff man does not become a father figure. Do you see what I mean? So by verbal reinforcement, I mean you're to encourage them in what they're doing, encourage them as people, and to help them, but without engendering just a total dependence and say, I like you, but nobody else does, or whatever it is. You know, say you're secure in my environment, but not in others. And we want to be sure that we give the right kind of enforcement. And then lastly, the issue of finances. Most women staff that I see are low financially, and that is a burden. Gentlemen, you think of what your wife sees when she gets a salary check of $22.50 in the mail, and you say, oh, well, praise God, and she goes, well, where am I going to buy food? Now, you just put that perspective out, and it'll help you just a bit. Let me just finish our time with comments on two other issues that I believe come up in our ministries, and it's this topic, how to integrate a stronger women's work. Now, here's what I mean. The women's work that becomes very solid, and then, say, a new man moves in, and the men's work is not doing as well. Okay? Do you see the picture? Now, sometimes this will happen, and the first thought is, well, you have to disintegrate the women's work so the men's work can grow. I'd like to give a few suggestions that I think will help, because we're going to have more and more of this. The first is that there has to be an attitude of serving each other. And the issue comes down to one initially of attitude. Have this attitude in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. The second thing, when issues of pride and competition, well, look at the woman's work, look how they're doing, or look at the men's work, or I'm doing better than you, or whatever the case may be. And I think that James 3:16 and 17 says, gives the answer. It says, "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing." And it will happen. So if we can deal with pride on both parts and competition, then I believe God will really bless. The third is the issue of humility. See, is it wrong to say, yeah, that woman has a capable ministry. And you've got more mature women in the ministry than our men are at this point in time. And for the man, I believe he must realize that he is to lead, to encourage, to take advantage of the depth that is there in that other ministry. He can even say, now guys, there are some mature women. Those are the kind of women that God's going to use. And it could be quite a comparison to seeing ones who are not growing spiritually. And then to trust one another. And for the woman, to hold back some, not to overpower the situation, which she could do. To submit in a proper way, maybe to deepen rather than broaden. To encourage the staff man to be at peace. And again, to trust one another in the context. And strive for unity in the ministry. Philippians 2, 3, and 4. I believe you need to have patience to realize that if the right leadership is given, that those works will equalize. There is nothing that I see in the Bible that says that a men's ministry must be more mature, you know, always than a women's. We find this often in marriages, of course, there are places where the woman is the more mature one of the two. Now, it's an imbalance, and it has to be dealt with, but divorce is not the answer. See? Then I believe just to find the security in God. For both, to realize that God is in charge. God, even when the woman may not get the precise leadership she needs at that moment, for her to trust God, that she is there by God's appointment. And lastly, as Lauren was shared with us many times, to surrender, because it is God's work. Now, just one last item that I'd like to share with you. There is some varying opinion on whether a work should be unified or separated. That is, a campus, the women's work is over here and the men's here, or should it be integrated and co-ed? I'd like to just give a little opinion. It can work in both ways, but I'd like to give a little plug for a unified ministry. And I'd like to give you some reasons for it. These are not all, because I just worked on this last night and yesterday, and I don't think it's as carefully thought through as I would like it to be. But first of all, the body of Christ as a whole, there is neither male nor female, and the body of Christ must function on a co-ed basis. Thus, I believe it's a good reason for us to have some functioning together. I believe we need to teach people to build healthy relationships, that we need to have people see that we can relate as men and women and do it in a godly, holy, healthy manner. In fact, in this current day of gay liberation, there have been some comments around on some campuses, I understand, it's reported to me, that they've looked at the navigator and says, is that a homosexual group? They're just men. You see men going with men everywhere. Or you see the women going with the women everywhere. And there's a slight tinge in today's environment of what the world views us as. We can't change that except by demonstrating differently. I think it has to do with our witness to the world, partially in what I've just said, that they see that the relationships can be healthy and good. I believe it prevents allows us to avoid competition, because we're one team. It is the real world. That's how you're going to live your life. And what people learn there is going to be, I think, far better. It brings out character issues. I'll never forget the first co-ed conference I took Air Force Academy guys to. It was one of the most revealing incidents I've ever seen in my life. We drove a whole slew of guys up to Denver to Pete Carpenter's house. Now, you know, we are totally men's ministry, no choice. And we got to Pete's house in Denver, and the guys walked into this co-ed environment, and it was just like a magnet. Wham! Out they went, and every one of them relating to one girl on a one-on-one basis. And it told me something. It says, you know, we haven't done too good a job on helping these guys learn how to relate to women. Because it immediately, they were pursuing a dating relationship almost. You know, that was the focus. Well, we had very little environment to try and help mend that area, and it was very hard. And we've had to deal with those issues. It was one of the disadvantages of the academy environment. So I believe that brought out some character issues we were able to put our finger on and deal with. Finally, I think it has to do with, we want to have it to do with balance. Have some separate activities, sure. I believe most of the grassroots Bible studies should be separate. Women with women and men with men. Integrate at the leadership level and segregate someone at the lower levels. But I've also seen situations where it's integrated, as I recall, I've seen so many ministries, but that it was integrated throughout. But not all the time. Women do need to be together as women, and men do need to be together as men. So a balance, flow, in and out, through the year. Well, let me just conclude with a couple statements, and then we'll just open it for questions. I'd like to just read to you. Marv Smith has just done an interesting study in his seminary work on the women in North American Protestant missionary movement. And he just made a couple statements in here that I thought were interesting. He says, but it is still true that women and children make up the majority of the world's population and that women are best suited to minister to their needs. The role of women in secular careers is becoming more prominent around the world and so forth. He makes some comments on that. And he says, new innovations are needed to reach the women of this world. Male leadership will not come up with them because they're not qualified and usually are not that interested. That's a pretty strong statement, but now it is, you know, one man's opinion. He says, they need to recognize the importance of women in the missionary movement, the unique contributions that God has created them to make, the needs in the world that only women can meet, the way God has used women in furthering the cause of Christ down through history, and give them an opportunity and encouragement to creative, innovative undertakings. And he concludes and said, there is the need today for women who will step out in faith and courage, inspiring and leading a host of new women missionaries and reaching the world for Christ. Now, all of those statements, it's an academic environment, but there is a need. We need women. We need women both to be trained to be wise. We need them to train to reach other people. We need women who will give their lives to the vision of the gospel and disciple making. And I believe that God will raise up women in our midst, who in the proper environment, and I believe will do well. I believe we in the NAS have been blessed with many capable, gifted, and godly women, both single and married. And we've not always treated them well or made it easy for them to pursue the disciple-making vision, which is in a predominantly male organization. And I thank God for their willingness to give themselves in the vision of multiplying laborers in an environment which is not always easy. And if we can just learn to work as co-laborers in the gospel in a harmonious, biblical, productive way, I can see great blessings in store for us. If not, I wonder how long God's hand of blessing will be on our personal ministry, since his focus is on the body, the total body, and the world, all the world. So in a time when the world, and even the Christian world, is being fractured over the emotional issues surrounding women and the family, I think we need to reach and train women who reach and disciple other women who will preserve the sanctity of biblical womanhood and the place of the family in Christianity. So I'd like to stop there and would like to have you, give you some opportunity for questions. Yes? Sure. Okay. How to identify the leadership? Okay. Well, first of all, you identify it in the same way you identify with men. I only know one way to identify a leader, and that is they got people following them. Now, if that doesn't happen, you don't have a leader. Okay. You can have all the courses you want. And I notice that certain people attract people to follow their lifestyle and character. And so you identify it in the same way, I believe. You see other women respond to them. You also see their ability to think and to perceive relationships, which is key in leadership. But how to put it in, it needs to be, in my estimation, under the auspices of a staff man. It has to be in the context of primarily of ministering to other women, because that is where their ministry focuses. We can learn from women. And they have many, many things to teach us. And you can discuss the issues of what the environment, whether small group, whatever, church, there's that little argument going on, but they can read the same Bible we can and can really and can communicate things to us. But the primary role and relationship, I believe that they will reach and lead other women. And as the women mature, then they and it will integrate into the whole of the body. But if the women whom they are leading see the integration with the women who are leading them, they will integrate. If not, they will form into a separate entity and go off and do their own thing. So that just a little bit of a idea. It's not easy, Kurt, but I think we can do it. And in fact, I think we must do it. Okay, some other questions? Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. Just, I believe that if the woman, that was in the context of a strong ministry, I believe that if there are times, just like in marriage, where we slow down the process a bit to allow the other person to catch up. You see what I mean? And you develop in different areas. You may develop more in depth, but instead of, you know, cranking the thing up to high gear in the women, you say, now we want that balanced ministry, and so we may hold back, not so much on the evangelism, but that we will do more in the area of supportive things for a period of time. Now, that's a choice that is made to make sure that it doesn't continue just to be out of balance. The strong ministry tends to become, well, there's a little saying, the strong become stronger and the weak become weaker. That's just a kind of a principle of life. And so there needs to be balance, and it can be done together instead of being forced and say, well, the only way to do this is to ship the girl out. You know, you move to another campus because it's too strong a work and we'll destroy it, and therefore we'll then let the men grow. Well, I really have a question if that is really dealing with the issues that are involved. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you need to promote it and you need to bring it into balance. But see, there the issue is that we are trying to train the men to be in the leadership role, and there I wouldn't be as much pressed to hold it back. In fact, I probably wouldn't. However, you want to be careful that it doesn't drown the women's ministries. See, the women's ministry is not the responsibility of the women's staff on the campus. It is the responsibility of the rep or the men's staff on that campus. He is responsible for the total ministry. Thereby, he must look at the total. If he wants to develop the total, he has to make choices. So I would encourage him then. He says, well, I have an area that's a bit weak. We need to work on building that. And you can't do every objective in every year. You see what I mean? You can't make everything strong through a cycle of a year. Yes.
Jerry, I'm still not clear on just this whole issue of pulling back now. It would appear to me that if you have a strong woman's ministry and you have a weaker men's ministry, that the way to approach it was to start doing some things with the men's ministry rather than pull back the woman's ministry.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that you just, you know, all of us know, you give me a campus and I can tell you how to crank it up and really make certain aspects of it spin, obviously. You know, like the campus, we have a campus rally. 80 women, 5 men. Well, you just kind of say, now maybe we ought not to have it quite like that all the time, and we may need to adjust certain of the activities and the public way we handle that. Now, this needs to be done in a very open way between the staff man and staff woman. It's not easy, but I believe it can be done. No, it's both. It's number, depth, it's the whole thing. But I just gave you one example. It may not be a deep ministry. You just have a lot of women because they'll come to women to meetings easier than men. Sometimes that's the case. Sometimes it isn't. But it has to do with the breadth. There are times when you have some very mature women on the scene, and it'll be a little intimidating to some of the younger guys coming up. And you just need to consider how you handle those relationships. I wish I could give you just 1, 2, 3 on that, but I'm pointing out an issue. I believe it can be done, but it'll need to be worked out locally. Okay, some other questions? Yes. Well, let me get one from a gal here. Yeah. It was. It's not a published article. It's simply a classroom paper that Marv Smith did in some current seminary studies in the missions movement.
Jerry, I was trying to...
I don't know whether there are or not. In the Old Testament, you didn't have women as Levites. Now, we call ours Levites, but I personally wouldn't say that we are Levites, because those ended, you know, at the when we changed from to the New Covenant. But there were certainly issues of women in a leadership role, and whether they earned it that way or not, I don't know. I think of Deborah. And there, I can't really say on that. I don't know the situation of Priscilla and Aquila. Of course, she was married. I don't know how Mary Magdalene and others earned their living. Maybe it was a family inheritance. I'm not sure. It's an area that even for us, you know, I don't know that it's all that clear. You know, people struggle with that. That would be a good one to research, wouldn't it? Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
Back on the issue of balance, as far mm-hmm. as the number of maturity of men versus women ministers, that's wrong word.
Mm-hmm.
and correlation with the women's ministry. Are you thinking, just maybe too specific, but are you thinking in terms of, for example, the women's ministry was larger and more developed, to perhaps have the women's staff workers work on things like follow-up or individual ministry, and back off a little on evangelism to give a chance for the men to go out and get larger numbers.
Right, to work on that. Yeah, that you could do some things like that. You may shift the emphasis. And see, if you get if the women in that situation are committed to the growth of the men's work, then they can spend a lot of time praying and asking God to raise up the men in that ministry also. Just the other way around, when the men's work is very strong, are the men also praying for the women's work to be strengthened and growing?
So missions where the women's ministry was larger in a certain section, they would spend one night on evangelism and one praying for the men who were doing two nights.
That could be a possibility. Or the other thing, on a multi-staffed campus, you could shift some of the women around. Plot the dorms and where it's strong. And you obviously want to match staff relationships also. Yeah.
This deals with wives, but in a situation where you have no women's rep, and the wives are free and are encouraged and are, you know, really actively involved on the campus, and you want to be there.
Good point.
Did you include them in on the planning, or is that for regional, local?
You asked for Jerry White. I would include, if my wife were doing that, I'd want her in on the planning if she has to execute part of it and to help. Now, let me make a comment. That's a very good point. Wives, you should be doing ministry. Some, according to your gifts. Some of you have more of an ability and a heart for it than others. But over your lifetime, I'd really like to see you doing discipling, both with your children and with some others. And some of you who are like some who have been women's reps or in the ministry, boy, you have a tremendous amount to contribute, both to the women that might be on the scene as well as to the ministry. You don't lose your heart for ministry just because you get married. But you need to do it in the context of your calling. And you have added or changed your calling. And just because there's a woman's rep on campus doesn't mean that the wife should not be involved in doing evangelism, ministering, and that she could not even at some points. There are some women who could actually lead the women's ministry. We have one, Carl and Barbie Vargo. And Barbie, they have no children, and Barbie basically leads the women's ministry. It's a good arrangement. We would not assign a woman's contact staff in that situation because she's doing it. And so I don't want to negate the wives' role, but she should not direct the women's staff, is what I'm saying. That's where I see complicated things getting into the system. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. That's a hard one to say. If they're friends, anything will work. If they're not friends, nothing will work. I mean, pardon my bluntness on that, but that's important. Yeah, Jim?
When we went to Nairobi, my wife and I were the only navigators there. My wife had the women's work. And a little later, a woman's worker came in, and my wife delighted.
Yeah, and I think that in general, that would be the case. Yeah. I'd hesitate to split the campus and say, you take this, and I don't want that competition, for instance, to start and something. So, well, I hope that this will have been a useful time. I feel